It's been 150 episodes of this podcast, and I've gone through a whole variety of subjects. For this particular episode, this special occasion, I thought I would dig really deeply into a memory so far in the past, so distant, that I almost have to wonder if it's real. But I'm fairly sure it is, and everything springs from it. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Peter Healy, Daniel Boyd, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. If you dig back far enough in your memories into places that you haven't been to literally for decades, then you're going to have some amount of fuzziness. With very few exceptions, you add years of embellishments, rewriting, and maybe even fabrication as you build the foundation of your life on it. Some of these memories just end up being simple parables or places where you got some sort of lesson that you've used for the rest of your life, a time when you thought you could accomplish something and couldn't and never went back to it, maybe a case of where you tried something different and then you found yourself able to do it, and ever since then you continue to do it, drawing on that one experience as the root for what you do now. I was in the middle of something which time will probably bury because I can't imagine it's going to stick around for very long. It's called a Twitter space, and it's essentially a Twitter-based phone conference meant to duplicate another successful program called Clubhouse, but actually based off of phone conferences that have been around many decades. You have a bunch of people who are able to hear each other, maybe you have some control over who gets to speak, and you just talk about stuff. I thrived and loved being in phone conferences, so this is a fun experiment for me, although it's once again revealing Twitter doesn't know how to do anything, and that it can become very weird just bringing in random folks and talking to them and trying to derive some sort of conversation from it. But I've been enjoying it, and like I said, I can't imagine it's going to stick around for very long. This conference idea will be with us forever, but Twitter's foray, maybe not so much. During one of these conversations, these freeform narratives where I was working on packaging some boxes and talking to various random folks, I suddenly recalled a memory straight out of the darkness that I hadn't thought about for almost all of my life. The sharpness tells me it probably comes from reality. And if it's true, an awful lot of who I am is built on it. In the early 1970s, when my parents were together and we lived in a suburban neighborhood built around the expansion of the IBM Corporation, there was a local supermarket that we would go to, which fulfilled all of the usual needs of a supermarket, market, and even a hardware store. When we walk back this far, nearly 50 years, the world is notably different. There's lots of aspects of it that are exactly the same, of course, but there were whole product areas completely gone and functions that have either moved away or stopped being relevant to daily life. Computers exist, networks exist, all sorts of online life is happening, but in a very distant and faraway place, a place where me, less than 5 years old, would never interact with them. And of course, there was no chance of me ever going to any businesses unless my parents were bringing me along. In this supermarket, there were the big windows out front where you could look inside and see all of the cashiers, and there were a number of machines all along the front of the market, which served all sorts of different functions, some of them completely gone and some of them here. If I had to make a jump and try to find something to connect it to in the modern era, Try to think of renting a carpet cleaner, where you have an industrial piece of equipment that you might not want to buy and you don't want to hire any workers. So there would be a machine out front with a sign, and you would pay the supermarket to take the cleaner home, use it, and then return it. There were a number of these different machines, half self-service, half requiring assistance, that made up this area. And it was natural, when I look back on it, that I would walk over to the window to these machines and be looking at them while my parents finished checking out. And next to the carpet cleaner and the coffee grinder where you could self-service grind your coffee, there was this other odd machine. The machine was a tube tester. It was a booth set up with two functions: to test your tubes and be able to buy replacements if it turned out what you owned was broken. Now here, the listeners split. Some people know exactly what I'm talking about, and still more have no idea. So historically, it helps to understand that tubes, vacuum-sealed pieces of glass with electronics inside of them, served a function in varieties of equipment, including radios and televisions, for a good period of time in the middle of the 20th century. And they ranged in price from extremely cheap, like a penny, up into something pretty expensive. I'm in no shape to explain everywhere they were used or how they were used, but people had them in their home, and they also needed to replace them whenever they burnt out. So, at the local supermarket, there was this small machine, and the machine had a number of plugs for a whole bunch of different standards that represented all the different ways that tubes could be plugged in. And then there were drawers underneath it with replacement sets of tubes, small glass bulbs with machinery inside them rolling around in a metal drawer, with a label outside to tell you what they were. Now, in the early 1970s, I am 4 or 5 years old. At that age, everything is looming. Everything looks enormous. The sound of parents and family rise above you from the clouds, and you get really focused on whatever things happen to be at your level. And this intact memory, like finding a pristine pamphlet inside of a book from the 1940s with every aspect of the print as bright and colorful as it was back then, every image as sharp as it was the day it was printed. I remember walking over to this display, finding something I could stand on because I was so small I couldn't reach the top of it, and then standing up and then reading with very little comprehension all of the things written in the little plugs on the backboard and with the small booklet that was chained to the side of it, and feeling a draw to everything about it. That there were these strange little tubes, and not knowing what they did, but seeing that something had made them, and they were beautiful and shiny. And inside of these drawers, which I was playing around in, I could see there were many of them, that there was this whole new world of weird toys that didn't explain themselves, that were not primary colored trains and blocks, but some other shiny metal artifact that I could never understand, that I could not get my mind around. The idea of standing in front of something without somebody showing it to me and it having instructions on it. This was the very first time, I think, that I understood that machines could do things with me. That I could be alone with something, something standing out in the world, and it and I could have a connection. This wasn't an appliance in my family's home, not the television, not the radio. This was its own special thing, and it came from somewhere mysterious, and it had a darkness and a wonder and a depth to it, a sort of alien artifact feel, that there was a puzzle of some sort here. There were things I needed to know. There were steps I had to take to really understand what this thing was. This moment must have been like lightning to me, and in such a way that I cannot even tell you how long it lasted, other than my parents must have noticed their kid playing around with the tube tester and came over and grabbed me and then took me out of the store with my eyes alight, thinking about that machine that had been there. As time progressed, that machine and many of the other machines out front disappeared. The functions they did were taken over by other pieces of equipment. They weren't sold through supermarkets. The integrated circuit was winning. We didn't need a tube tester at arm's length when we were getting our vegetables or going through to buy dairy. But I am fairly sure, looking back, that that was ground zero for my moment at which I took a journey of curiosity, of wonder, with both the machinery and the forces and the people behind them that has continued to this day. And as that memory came flooding back while I was messing around with a new piece of technology that connected people in strange and unusual ways, and during a time when I was trying to piece together how I would use this technology and what it meant and what was working behind it, I realized that it was all one unbroken chain. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to James Bekoyanu, Mark Pilgrim, Corey Thomas, Emilio Oliveira, Matt Reynolds, Ernie Hershey, Michael Rubin, and Anonymous, along with the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. When I started working on this podcast, it was for very specific reasons, and I wasn't focusing on all the other effects that it would have. The fact that I'm at 150 episodes tells me that unintentionally we've stumbled onto something I needed to tell these stories, and you've been allowing me to do so for years now. Thank you so very much for that gift as well.